Welcome to the final episode of the Damage Reporter this week. My voice is just barely holding, and I think I can probably get past the finish line.
I don't.
Especially with the help of Brett Ehrlich.
I don't think you can make
How's it,
John.
Going, Brett?
It's not looking good.
Here's what's not going to happen today, Brett. We are not going to do this.
Just know that earlier today, John was trying to talk while his bronchioles were just not supplying the oxygen.
Okay. So there's a lot that's going to happen, and normally I tell you what's going to happen. We got representative from Sunrise Movement's going to join us. Lauren Duke is going to be here in a little bit, but we got just too much to get to, so we're launching right into it with Joe Biden. Okay, okay.
Don't wait for me to answer. Just go.
I was waiting for the B-roll, actually. Okay.
Interest. There it is.
There we go, Joe. Okay, let's do this thing. Joe Biden had an interaction with Kamala Harris last night on the debates, and I think pretty much everyone agreed that it went fine for him, and he doesn't have anything to apologize for. That's ridiculous. It was not a good interaction for him. She brought up his history of support for busing, and his most recent comments, not in the 70s, but like a week ago, about how segregationists are just sort of people you gotta work with and stuff like that. So he was approached by a reporter immediately after the debate. The reporter had to get him to stop signing autographs and smiling with that ridiculous pearly white grin of his to answer a question about it, and here's what he said.
She made the argument that this was very personal to her, that this was essentially an issue that the federal government should have a role interacting in the local space here.
Well, it should. It should have a role by breaking down the barriers that exist in institutional racism. Mm-hmm. That's what I did when I was a local official and a county official. But what we're talking about is whether or not the Department of Education, as opposed to the courts, mm-hmm. could order de jure segregation, meaning segregation imposed by law. There's de facto and de jure. Segregation. I supported the court's ability to strike down to order busing. Matter of fact, I voted against an amendment that came up in the Senate. It was the deciding vote for a senator here in Florida. It was called the Gurney Amendment. I was the deciding vote. He wanted to take away the power of the court to stop busing. I voted against it. In the middle of the year, we had the largest busing order.
So the issue for Joe Biden here is that Joe Biden is just wrong. And as with so many other issues, he refuses to accept or understand how he's wrong. What he is saying there, and it's to some extent what he said on the stage, is it's great, Kamala Harris, if your area decided eventually after a couple of decades to act right. But if other areas didn't, I don't think the federal government should do anything about it. You are at the whims of whether or not your local city council are just a little bit racist or really, really racist. And I'm not going to do anything about it. And he really does seem to think that that is an acceptable response on this topic.
Yeah, I totally understand everything you're saying. I'm not going to repeat it. I will say that one of the big challenges of running for office in America is to get people to get past like just things they're seeing before they can start listening. Mm. Joe Biden, for me, I can't get past the like, are you okay?
What do you
like,
mean?
Is he physically okay? He looks 1,000 years old. He pauses to remember the word education. It's distracting.
And
yeah. So it's all like, to me, that's like if someone has a giant thing of spinach in their teeth. I'm just like, I really want to listen to what you're saying right now to really interpret your counterargument. But I wonder how many Americans are able to get past the part where he just looks 1,000.
Well,
and I just want to say, like, I think there could have been a giant moment in the debate. One of those transgenerational moments. If someone after Biden gave the moment where he says, like, oh, my time's up. If someone on that stage looked at him and went, are you okay?
Or said, no, you need to continue. You can have my time.
False. That's wrong. I'm right for this reason. Because Americans in those debates, a lot of them, the ones that were scared, like aren't really listening, but are just kind of intuiting things. I think if someone just asked, are you okay? Do you need a minute?
I think there's a good chance that would be seen as being ageist. And especially the thing you have to bear in mind.
Oh, when the trending topic was pass the torch?
Yeah, and I think that a lot of older primary voters are going to not like Swalwell for what he said there. Because you have to remember that the voting public is older than the public at large. I would say in the primary, that's probably even more the case.
I don't think the person who created that moment would benefit from it. But I think it would be a giant moment.
Yeah, I look, we can have our disagreement. I think that this is like a mile away from the core of the issue, which is that he's wrong on this issue. He refuses to simply accept it and apologize. And that is actually going to be sort of borne out in the follow-up question of the last video we just showed you. Let's take a look.
Is it frustrating to you in the year 2019 to be relitigating these debates at this point?
Yeah, it should be about the future. It should be about what we're going to do to deal with institutional racism. And it's real. We should be talking about what we should be doing in the prison system. For example, the idea that we allow prison, and the legislation we passed, said no private prisons, didn't get through. But the fact of the matter is, I think we should not be sending anyone with a drug problem into a prison. They should go into rehabilitation system. We should be training people in jail how to read and write. When they get out, they not only should have their rights restored to vote, they should all have all their benefits available to them. Pell Grants and so on. So this is, we're going at this backwards.
Okay, so no, he's going at this backwards, because in the first few seconds of that video, he was wrong a couple of times. One, he's frustrated that he has to relitigate this. He's the one that brought up segregationists last week. He says we should be talking about the future. You are constantly talking about the past, occasionally the 70s, but generally you're just talking about how things were under Barack Obama. You are one of the only candidates on the stage not focusing on the future and presenting a positive agenda for what you hope to achieve if you become president. You represent the, hey, let's just get back to how things were back in 2012. Weren't things great then?
Yeah, but I.
That's his message.
That's his hope. He's hoping for Make America Boring Again. Mm-hmm. Like he's like, it's like when you watch, I tried to watch every episode of, what's the zombie one? Of Walking Dead. And I was just like, I can't feel like this
all
for this long all the time. I wanna watch cartoons. Can we just go back to watching cartoons?
Put on the Big Bang Theory.
But what people are pointing out is like, okay, if we were to go back to watching cartoons and or we just wanna make America boring again, it was boring for you. It was boring for like suburban white people, and suburban white people liked it because it was fine. But the boring, happy, romanticized version of the past is a horror show as far as civil rights are concerned.
Exactly, and that's another thing that he simply does not get. Okay, but there was other stuff going on at the debates, and I do want to turn to an interesting topic that came about later last night. Andrew Yang was present at that second debate, and you might have noticed that you didn't hear much from him. And he actually has a theory for why that was. Take a look at him talking with a group of what it seems like his supporters later on last night.
And there were also a few times, FYI, where I just started talking, being like, hey, I'd like to add something there, and my mic was like, nah. Like, it's not like if you just start talking, like, it all of a sudden, like, takes over the convo. It's like, I was talking, and, like, nothing was happening, and it was like, oh. So that happened a bit, too.
When they ask other kind of questions, you should jump in to answer the question.
No, I agree. And like, again, like there were times where I was like, hey, I wanted to make a contribution on climate change or education or other things. And like, my mic didn't work. Like, your mic's actually not on. And so I would just start talking. And then like, the moderators would just like ignore and doesn't matter. So the moderators have a fair amount of power and authority, including someone in production is like turning on a mic or not.
So, I can imagine that would be incredibly frustrating. And people have also shared one or two videos where you can, the camera's not really on him, but you can see him in the background, and it does look like he's attempting to get in, but you don't actually hear his voice.
Right, and they never went, they went to him once.
Yeah.
Once, ever, was like a question directed at Andrew Yang. Mm. It was very early on, he said that, and then they came back to him for closing statements.
You mean like directly going in?
Directly going in. They went to Marianne
Williams.
It was once.
Yeah.
I don't know. I kind of had other stuff to do. But when he talked to Cenk after, and you can see that it's posted on the Young Turks YouTube channel, they did a little back and forth. And he said he was happy because he's already crossed some thresholds that get him in the next two debates, or at least he's on track to do it. So, in his words, he has three more bites at the apple, or two more bites at the apple.
Yeah, but. I mean, what is the bite going to be if they again don't ask him questions and don't let him cut in? It's going to be hard to really break out if you're being hemmed in that way.
I do. Yeah, I heard him when he was trying to talk sometimes, but I think obviously there are other things that the moderators have their sights on, and he really does have the opportunity. It's weird. I have like some people who are not interested in politics that I talk to about this kind of stuff, and they, whether they agree with Yang's policies or not, they're just so refreshed when you tell them things like, so he's got this universal basic income thing that he calls the freedom dividend. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, oh, that's real smart. Yeah. Like, just, I don't know what universal income is. It seems crazy to me. I'm like, you can think it's crazy, but how genius is it that he calls it the freedom dividend? So people called him socialist. Like, but that sounds like something I buy at the Trump store.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's good at the terminology. And look, what he needs right now, I think, is between now and the next debate, he needs like a CNN town hall or something like that. I think that would really help him. Just really fast, if we can bring up this chart, it's going to show you just from last night how long each candidate spoke to give you an idea of the disparity. Andrew Yang spoke for 2 minutes and 50 seconds. Joe Biden in first, 12 minutes, 53 seconds, many times longer. What I found interesting when I looked at a chart that mashed up both nights, the amount of speaking time was almost directly in the same order as how people are polling. That Joe Biden was at the top and you had people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. You can see there Kamala Harris talked a little bit longer than him. That's almost entirely because of the interaction with Joe Biden. And then you get people like Buttigieg and Booker, it's not visible there. And then as you get down to people who are polling at 2 or 1 or 0%, they tended to talk less, which I think is a combination of the moderators not going to them as much, not being as willing to let them cut in, but also in some cases, a little bit of maybe timidity, like they feel a little bit uncomfortable with cutting in maybe.
Yes, I totally believe Andrew Yang that the people were probably told, because people's mics were up early on.
Yeah, Rachel Maddow wasn't looking at Andrew Yang like, oh, do you want to get in? I'll let you get in. She wasn't doing that.
But specifically from an audio perspective, everyone's mics were on at the beginning and that stopped happening. I tweeted a joke like, here's the transcript, and I just mashed down on my keyboard because it was everyone speaking at once. I think they accounted for that later, but they do start with the highest polling people, even though they started with Bernie before Biden. But they do that on purpose. They put the high polling people in the middle, and it's kind of a, well, make yourself heard and known. Yeah. Because the moderators aren't going to help. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. We're going to be focusing on another aspect of the debates, the coverage, the little that there was on climate change after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
When you ask the Democratic primary electorate what their top issues are, climate change is right up there at the top of the list. Multiple of the candidates at the last two nights of debates listed it as the biggest threat facing America today. And so obviously there had to be a lot of talk about it at a presidential debate. I mean, that is the person with the most single power to do something about it. Unfortunately, not really. And joining us now to talk about climate change and the debates, Varshini Prakash, co-founder and executive director of Sunrise Movement. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Always glad to have you on. First of all, overall, the amount of questions about climate change at these two nights of debates, the substance with which they went into the topic, did it meet your expectations?
I wouldn't say that it did. You know, it was a mixed bag for us the last couple of nights. We as young people and as climate advocates are pretty used to this issue being completely sidelined in our presidential election. I think in 2016, it was less than 2% of total time during the election cycle was devoted to climate change, and not a single question was asked about it during the general election cycle. So comparatively, we saw a cumulative maybe 20 minutes or less probably on both Wednesday and Thursday nights devoted to the climate crisis. The first night, honestly, the questions were pretty abysmal. It was slightly better last night, in large part due to candidates like Kamala Harris talking about her support for a Green New Deal, saying that we need to talk about this as a crisis, not just as climate change, but a climate crisis. Bernie Sanders bringing up the role of the fossil fuel industry and the corporate capture of our government that has stymied progress on this issue for decades.
And I know that there had been a big conversation over the past few weeks about having a debate focused entirely on climate. And honestly, after watching these debates, I'm not sure who I would trust to do that, because it wasn't just that there weren't a lot of questions about climate change. Like, I noticed, like, when Chuck Todd was asking the questions, it came off to me as a sort of begrudging thing. Like, he barely wanted to talk about it. There was no passion there. And although I've read that something like 15 minutes of the two nights of debate were about climate change, as a person who that is my core issue, it didn't feel like it at times.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what I noticed was that there is a significant lack of climate literacy amongst the media and political establishment right now. Every single one of the issues that was discussed, whether it was immigration, whether it was the economy, whether it was racial justice and increased mass incarceration, all of those issues are deeply, inextricably intertwined with the climate crisis. And so for folks to sort of relegate it to the realm of environmentalism and talk about it about an hour and a half in every night, long after many of the young people that I was watching these debates with had curfews and had to go to bed, was deeply disappointing. And I think there's a lot of work to be done.
So did any of the responses, did any of the candidates stand out on this issue for you?
Yeah, I think in particular last night, I was blown away by Kamala Harris's performance just broadly across the board. Obviously, there was that remarkable moment between her and Joe Biden where she called him out for his racist history. And I think also the moment when Pete Buttigieg answered questions about farmers and the way in which the climate crisis is affecting the Midwest right here in this country and how farmers have to be a part of the solution. And Bernie Sanders as well really stood out. I would say on Wednesday night, you know, Elizabeth Warren just minutes out was connecting the climate crisis to the broader issue of building economic power as Americans and also investing big in green technology, was calling out the role of the fossil fuel industry in corrupting our government as well. And I thought we saw Jay Inslee, Beto O'Rourke to a certain degree, and also Julian Castro really come out shining as well.
Yeah, I did. I found it interesting. I was watching Jay Inslee, you know, to see how strongly is he going to push on this sort of core issue in his candidacy. And it was interesting that when asked at the end to list the biggest threat to America, he didn't say climate change. Others did.
Yeah, it was interesting too. I was kind of surprised by that. I think we would have also liked to see from these candidates a little bit more. Almost all of them support the Green New Deal, and Kamala Harris was one of the folks that actually came out and said it. And I was hoping to see from many of these other candidates, like Bernie Sanders, Jay Inslee, Elizabeth Warren, some explicit support for the Green New Deal, considering that it really aligns with so much of the economic vision that many of them are putting forward as well.
So we'd been talking about a climate focused debate. The hope was, if we're not going to have that, hopefully they'll take it more seriously in the debates. To some extent, the moderators did, although not much. I saw after, I believe, the first night, I think it was Chris Hayes tweeted about now he does think that we might need one. And I tweeted to him, hey, you're in a position to possibly talk to management about that.
So
what do we do? What do we do after this? What does the Sunrise Movement do to either get that debate or make sure that we don't have a repeat of this experience the next couple of times around?
Totally. Well, look, young people have been turning up the heat for weeks, in fact. The DNC has been giving us all sorts of excuses, saying that it's impractical, saying that the climate crisis is a quote-unquote single issue that doesn't merit its own debate, saying that it's against the rules. I will say, as a young person living in America right now, considering that the entire planet is about to be on fire, I couldn't care less about the rules, and we are making that clear. So young people have been camped out and sitting in at the DNC headquarters in DC all week, actually. They slept out multiple nights, held debate watch parties on the steps of the DNC as well, and are continuing the call for weeks to come. We are going to only elevate this campaign to call on the DNC for a climate debate, and more voices are joining us from not only climate organizations, but groups like Move On and United We Dream and the NAACP and more.
You know, I just, while I have you here, I wanted to get your brief reaction to a story we're going to be covering in depth a little bit later on the show. I'm sure you're aware about the massive, deadly heat wave that's striking Europe right now. You've probably also seen the big wildfires in Spain that I read were apparently caused when a massive pile of manure self-ignited because of how hot it was. Those wildfires have already killed two people. So as someone who's very worried about how this is proceeding internationally, what do you think about what Europe is currently experiencing?
I mean, it's just, you know, one more example of how we are careening closer and closer to climate catastrophe. And this isn't an issue 30 years from now. People are experiencing it in this moment. The West Coast is on fire. We're seeing the fires just minutes from Miami. It was very poignant about it. I think what was even more hurtful about how little time the climate crisis received on the stage at the debates was that it was taking place in Miami.
Yeah.
A location that will be literally underwater in mere decades if we don't do something significant right now. So I think, you know, it's incumbent upon all of us. We know that the folks like the DNC and institutions like that are never the leaders in moments like this. They're always the followers. It's incumbent on young people, people who will be the directly impacted by the climate crisis, to step up and raise our voices in unison, because I think that's the only thing that's going to change the political tide in this country.
Well, Varshini, we always appreciate having you on. Thanks for taking out time to respond to the debates. And you know, hopefully they'll take it more seriously if that's going to happen. You know, unfortunately, a lot of it is on activists like you. So go get them.
But if you want to join us, go to sunrisemovement.org, because that campaign is in full swing right now. And we need every help that we can get.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break. We come back. Donald Trump is abroad meeting with Vladimir Putin. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the subjects that were raised during that meeting after this. And that was Donald Trump meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin and telling him not to meddle, but not in the tone I just said it. Instead, he was laughing and Putin was laughing, and it was a great joke. You're a comedian, actually, Brett. How good of a joke was it?
So good.
This I thought it was funny.
This is not a laughing matter. That's how funny it was.
Mm-hmm.
It killed. I'm just happy he solved it. He did it.
He did it.
He was asked to whether they'd meddle, and he basically told him not to meddle. So now it's not a problem.
Yeah.
This is one of those moments where it's like, I didn't learn anything new.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, oh, it stinks more like fart in here, but it already stank like farts before.
Yeah. Now it's just, it's the same smell, it's but like, it's moister and warmer.
And I can smell like a specific food they ate, but I was disgusted before, and now it's like that plus, like, I don't know, falafel.
Yeah,
like, you're just like, ugh.
Look at the smile on his dumb fascist face.
But what is he supposed to do?
Well, here's the thing that I learned. Donald Trump is basically a genie. If you're going to wish something, you have to be very specific or he'll screw you over.
You didn't say it in a way people would pay attention to.
Yeah. Don't mock the idea that the American people should be able to depend on the fact that their vote will actually be counted and will matter for choosing their elected representatives.
Right. Here's what is specifically wrong with it. he, in doing this like strange half resign, like don't meddle in the election, what he wants to do is be like, all right, what do you expect me to do right now? Get up and be like, you, sir, with fire and damnation, mm-hmm. I say, do not meddle in my elections. Mm-hmm. No, he's like, ugh, don't meddle in our elections. What am I supposed to do? But in doing he acknowledges just how little he cares about this and how weak he is. He doesn't stand up to a guy that everyone knows is just a bully fart.
Yeah, here's the thing. So could you defend the security of American elections with one-tenth the vigor that you defend a drone that got shut down? Like, if you can get pissed off about that, if you can get all like, oh, I'm gonna do something, can you pretend that it matters? And we know that it doesn't. As you said in the beginning, this isn't news. We know that he doesn't care. We know that he's blocked any both internal or international efforts to do something to make sure that Russia or China or whoever doesn't mess with our elections. And by the way, I know that it's not often stated, but if an international actor can do it, a big corporation, a tech company could do it hypothetically. They've got the expertise, they got the manpower and the money. Like, we should worry about all of this, but we have put into power people who feel like, for whatever reason, a lot of people just have this weird block where if you talk about anything related that seems like it has something to do with the 2016 election or Trump or Russia, all their sense goes out the door, all their values go out the door, and you're not allowed to talk about any of this. But I care about elections, and so I'm gonna keep doing it.
Yeah, I think he could say things like, oh, he can try. Mm-hmm. But we have put things in place to keep that from happening. But he can only say that if it's true, and he hasn't.
Yeah. Here's my solution: get him out of office. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to do it. It's just a little bit harder to do it when he's gonna have the sort of help he's gonna get. But there is a second video, so let's move on. They had other fun things that they talked about. So there you had the president joking about the fact that he has to deal with fake news and Russia doesn't have it, and Vladimir Putin reassured him, no, I hate the media too. And maybe they do. I don't know what the situation with fake news is like in Russia, but I know that they have a different solution to the problem of fake news. And that is that the Russian government has killed literally dozens of journalists over the past decade or so. We don't have time to go through all of them because they've killed and locked up so many journalists. But let's just mention a few. Freelance journalist Anastasia Babarova was shot and killed back in 2009 on a sidewalk in central Moscow as she attempted to intervene when a human rights lawyer, renowned for his work on abuses in Chechnya, was also murdered by a masked gunman. Now, to be fair there, they were trying to kill human rights lawyers. They just happened to also kill a journalist, so we do have to be fair. Mikhail Beketov suffered brain damage and lost a leg after a brutal assault in 2008 following his reporting around a campaign against a highway project in Moscow. He was in a coma for several months and spent more than 2 years in hospitals. He died 5 years later. His attackers were never found. It's weird, the attackers are never found, oddly enough. One more, Kadza Murad Kamilov, founder of a newspaper in Russia's North Caucasus, critical of authorities, was gunned down outside his office. I'm not gonna even attempt to explain that name. In December of 2011, Kamilov's leading independent weekly paper, Chernovik, has reported extensively on police abuses. His killers were also never found. We could do a whole show where we just read about the details of journalists and activists and lawyers who have been murdered for their activism. But it's fun to joke about when you're with Trump.
Right. So for all of Trump's speech about freedom of speech and his defense of the First Amendment when it comes to censorship of his fans, also in that First Amendment guarantees the sanctity of the press.
Yeah.
So that is a wild hypocrisy there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of people that love to pretend that they hate censorship, they hate violations of free speech rights. And I've noticed that in general, they only bring it up when it potentially could directly impact their financial bottom line. But if you are not going to advance progressive values of defending literally the lives of people who are trying to shed light on these sorts of things, then I don't think you care about freedom of speech as much as you think you do.
And just one quick thing, Mathal Hassan referred to this on the main show yesterday, but it bears repeating. It's that part of dictators and fascists is weirdness. Mm-hmm. It's joking. It's, is he serious? Because if someone said, hey, I'm gonna take people's rights away and I'm gonna do it with a straight face and I'm starting now, you would be like, that's insane. But it's incremental. And so Trump is
unless
able-
it's an out-group. Well, they're okay with that.
Right, Trump benefits from this ambiguity of whether he's joking or not, to communicate and dog whistle to certain groups who take it as serious, but then also to the press who see a president and have some kind of respect for the legacy of their job. They let him get away with it. And if we keep letting him get away with it, we run the risk of ending up in this fascist state. And in the meantime, he's undergoing, he's perpetrating this gross hypocrisy that undermines the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, I agree. He needs us to eventually be like, it's just jokes. It's the same jokes. Let's not talk about it. It's just so much.
You did it 2 days ago.
Should we really keep talking about it? And some people have been lulled into that false sense of normalcy. And the thing is, maybe we're wrong. And maybe he won't go as far as we're worried. I would rather freak out for a couple of years and not have our country descend into fascism rather than just be like, well, I don't want to seem like I'm bothered all the time.
Right. Cause and it's for your own mental. It's all right, John. Don't overreact.
That's how bothered I am. I be like flying.
I just want to say that I listened to a speech aired in its entirety on Fox News of Trump to a religious group. And in that, he mentioned how these people won't let me joke around. These are the two things in a row. One, they won't let me joke around. You have to smile big, he says, and show that you're joking. They can't take a joke. Anyways, these Democrats, they are allowing a baby to be born. They swaddle it, then they kill it.
Yeah.
So he is saying, he's doing exactly that. Give me some leeway with the truth because I might be joking. And then he's lying.
Then lying.
And he can't do that. He cannot be allowed to do that.
I agree. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. Lauren Duke is going to be joining us. Give a little bit more reaction to this first round of debates after this. Joining us now to react to the first two nights of debate is friend of the show and author of How to Start a Revolution, Young People and the Future of American Politics. Lauren Duca, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
glad to have you here. I've been enjoying your Twitter activity during the debates. And you not only have the book that we want to talk about and your recent op-ed in The Independent, but I want to give you an opportunity, first of all, just take it where you will. What did you think about this first go around?
I mean, I'm honestly really energized. I think that if we look at this conversation and the things that are seen as baseline in terms of immigration and healthcare, especially, but across the board, what is possible and kind of the parameters that define that have really radically changed. And the standard that Joe Biden is held to kind of in keeping with this race and this divide of, do we want big structural change? Do we want to build a new system or do we want a return to the status quo and the before times? I think that question is increasingly pushing towards a grander overhaul. It's not necessarily a binary question, but more something that is a grander thing that all of the candidates are navigating in a different way. And overall, we see a bigger push toward emphasizing equality. And that's amazing.
And I think Biden's probably the best example of one of those sort of philosophical approaches to this candidacy. He's not the only one, of course. I would say that, you know, someone like Delaney probably is in the same sort of camp, Hickenlooper for the most part, and others possibly too. I want to read one line from your recent op-ed.
Okay.
You said, America is in the midst of a political awakening moment and it is irreversible. But some of them are trying to reverse it. Can they? They might not succeed at that, but can they succeed in getting elected as that process is going on?
I think that the biggest, most powerful shift that has happened since the 2016 election is a total new alignment in the way we think about politics. And it happened for me where I was totally on board with the Biden-Obama bromance. And I had rose-colored glasses on, frankly, for Obama's presidency. I think there's been a grander reckoning in terms of what we count as acceptable, extending to neoliberal nonsense. And what counts as exciting at this point is not something that Joe Biden has on offer. John Delaney definitely falls in that camp. Amy Klobuchar is definitely more of a moderate as well. And the way John Delaney puts it is, you know, saving what's working and fixing what's broken. And it's about these little repair jobs on a system that I believe Donald Trump is the symptom of the disease, you know, that is ailing our democracy. And that's kind of the big stance. Do these candidates want to treat him as if he is an anomaly? And I think this awakening moment is about not only reacting to the atrocity of his win, but thinking critically about our role in government that is supposedly by and for the people, and the responsibilities that are required of us in that.
So there were 20 candidates. We've talked about a few. Is there anyone else that that you hadn't previously been thinking seriously about, but now you find yourself more interested in? Is there someone who stands out as having done the most to benefit their chances at this point?
I thought Julian Castro was absolutely stunning. The precision with which he centralized the question of criminalization of immigration, making that a specific litmus test, bringing Section 1325 to the fore and not allowing for any ambiguity on that question was absolutely fantastic. I don't know that he's necessarily a front runner as a serious presidential contender, maybe more of an issue candidate, but that was an extremely, extremely successful use of the debate stage. And I think that he's going to be in the conversation in a much more prominent way. And, you know, meanwhile, Beto looked like he had just been in a car accident. So I'm not really sure. But if there's a Texan now, it's for sure Castro.
Okay, so we're going to check in on Beto, make sure that he's okay. You know, some of the damage of a car accident might not manifest for a day or two.
Chocó su carro en la pared.
Did anyone else, in your view at least, do significant damage to their chances? Did anyone else kill their candidacy?
I mean, let me, you know, it's amazing to me that I thought one of the biggest takeaways was how little room there was for this kind of menage of random, mostly older white men to break through. And kind of like when a white man was speaking, it was sort of annoying and distracting in a way that they seemed like a monolith to me. And that, I mean, I've just never had that experience, right? Watching a debate, which was found fantastic. I don't know if any of them did significant damage. It felt more as if the old white man demographic took a big hit, right? Because none of them, I don't think, really stood out in any amazing way, where you have Elizabeth Warren wearing her heart on her sleeve with every single detail-driven answer. I mean, Kamala Harris's performance last night was absolutely dazzling. And the way that both of them, in addition to Castro, were able to capture public imagination and command the stage, I don't think we saw that from any of the typical front runners. And that's really exciting.
So, you know, we had the 20 people on the stage, 10 last night, but there were other people in the room. So I want to get your response to something that I noticed talked about a lot on Twitter. Should Todd be chucked at this point?
What is happening? I know, it's like, are you guys sending us your best people? How is that the best possible moderator we have for this critical moment in American history? This primary is so fundamental. And we have Chuck Todd. It's like Armando Iannucci wrote his dialogue. I mean, the haplessness with which he was moderating is unbelievable. Chris Saliza maybe would have done a worse job. I'm struggling to think of someone.
I haven't watched enough of Veep to get that yet, but I'm going to watch the rest of the show, come back, and I'll appreciate that joke far more. So let's talk about How to Start a Revolution. I've read a lot online about the process of writing this book, which seems like it was a fraught experience for you, as I hear most writing is. How do you start a revolution?
You start a revolution by choosing to pursue action in reaction to this moment. So many of the young people that I spoke to, I did hundreds of interviews, had over 350 written testimonials, and spoke to hundreds of young people around the country. The Awakening is available to everyone, but I believe it will be led by young people. And what I see is a shift from passively navigating a broken system to actively seeking to change it. And it hinges on the impossibility of Trump's election, because we were told that there was no way that was going to happen. So it's about the atrocities he's committed. It's about the cruelty towards the marginalized. It's about the unabashed embrace of authoritarianism. But it's also about what we were told and the way we trust our political and media gatekeepers, and the way that is shifting, and the things that we consider possible in terms of the way things are done in a political space, who gets to partake in the political conversation. And I'm an example of that. I am someone who is frequently, you know, dismissed on a basis of youth and gender in a way that my male counterparts would never be, but I'm breaking through and able to maintain an audience in this space. And you have AOC being able to run a campaign and rise to power and more women entering into Congress than ever before. I mean, you have Caban in Queens just this past week. We're having these little, these major movements on the Richter scale happening. The Parkland students are another huge example of breaking through the idea that gun violence is an inevitability. It's all about moving the needle on what we consider possible and insisting on something more and something different and something better. Because if the world is going to be this excruciating and ugly, then we have an urgency of action to demand something better for ourselves and for the collective. And I think that that is incumbent upon all of us. And if we can all show up to voice our, to raise our voices and use individual action, we can build to the collective power and be part of the process of returning America to the hands of the people, which is also what is on stage at these debates. The question of who has ownership of the money and power that define life in this country. And while I'm not personally a Bernie fan, I do agree with the framing of the 99%. And the reality is that America doesn't have control of our democracy right now. And our voices are statistically non-significant. But in building them to a collective, we have the chance to retain the power of the public good. And I think we have some leaders who are emerging who can continue to set us on that course, and the shift is already underway.
Well, it's obviously an incredibly timely book. It's How to Start a Revolution. And Lauren, as always, thank you for joining us. We always appreciate your perspective.
Thank you so much.
We're gonna have a short break here. We come back, a heat wave is sweeping through Europe. It's already claimed multiple lives. There's actually, oddly, a fun twist to it at the end. So we're gonna try to end the week with just a little bit of lightness after this. It really can't be said enough, climate breakdown is not a problem for the 2030s, the 2040s, or the 2050s. It's something that we're experiencing every day. And today, and throughout this week, Europe has been experiencing it with a massive heat wave that has already claimed multiple lives. Take a look at this chart. We're gonna show you a heat map of Europe. And I understand that each of those countries is very small. You can't see the particular numbers, but that shows that spiking temperatures are happening throughout Europe. And in those areas, you have a lot of places that are simply not set up. The populations are not set up to deal with these sorts of increases in heat. And especially in the cases where the heat is leading to things like wildfires. For instance, two people have already died from heat in Spain. And just to give you a brief historic thing, this is not just something that's happening right now. The number of heat waves in France has doubled in the past 34 years. It's expected that it's going to double again before 2050.
This, I can't read your tone on this. It's a good thing?
Not really, no.
Europe's so hot right now. Look at the ancient maps of Europe, all of that was above the water and now it's underwater. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it was 3 years ago or 3 million years ago.
It's one of the two.
But the climate, it fluctuates and the weather's nice outside today. That's literally what our Department of Agriculture head Purdue said the other day, his actual defense was, it's nice out.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's not a joke, and yet we're a joke when it comes to this topic. But I wanna give you an idea of how serious this can be. People have already died in Europe in this heat wave. The heat wave back in the summer of 2003 in Europe killed at least 30,000 people, causing €13 billion in financial damages. Some estimates think the death toll might be as high as 70,000. At that point, it was the hottest summer for Europe since the 16th century. And if you don't understand how this can be so deadly, understand that Europe is supposed to be relatively temperate. That means that the people, their actual bodies are not ready for this. They're more affected by the heat when it comes. I read a stat, by the way, in Germany, 2% of homes have air conditioning. And so when suddenly a massive heat wave comes and you've got young people, you've got the elderly, they can't just turn on the AC and it does, you'll wreak havoc in terms of number of deaths.
Two people dying is a tragedy. 2 million people dying is a statistic. 2 billion people dying is unfathomable. So what else you got? Like that's what it is, and that's the struggle. And that's, I think, what plays out in the debates also. Like what you're doing by doing this segment is trying to communicate to people, let's actually take this seriously, because you're trying to put it in the statistic category as opposed to the I can't even wrap my mind around that category. But what works against us in these situations, especially as it relates to the debates, is they don't know, as Lauren was talking about, the moderators know how to take a debate and put it through the filter of what they have been filtering it through for years. They just literally have not figured out how to do that. I think if you look at moments like this where you're saying, okay, we have people dying today and now due to heat wave, the only thing that's missing is who's winning? Who is the hero? How do I become that hero?
She was on earlier today on the show.
Or who do I rally behind? It is people like Varshini.
Yeah. So really fast, you're right. Stats, I think, should tell the tale, but they don't. That's not what gets people's attention. So I've got something else for you. They're experiencing a massive wildfires in Catalonia, a blaze the worst in the last 20 years that could double in size already. It's already the worst, could double in size. Do you want to know how that fire started? Authorities said the fire likely began when an improperly managed pile of manure self-combusted in the heat, causing sparks. Climate breakdown is so bad that our poop is setting on fire, okay?
I want John and I to do a field piece where we go learn how to properly manage a pile of manure. So this kind of stuff doesn't happen.
No, we're gonna do a field piece where we just keep a camera on a pile of manure and wait for it to explode.
Instead of MOS, which is man on the street, it's POS.
I got it. I got it. Thank you as always. That was fun. Thank you everybody. We're gonna be back next week. You know what happens. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.